so cold here today.
It's raining here. Are you kidding me? I didn't even know
what
to do. I know.
I mean, that's actually really good news considering yesterday's news item.
That's the news.
Oh, well,
wait till my actual news item, which I have fallen in love with. Anyway, hey, everybody, it's Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday here on Make Me Smart. None of us, as we like to say on this program, only on Tuesdays apparently do we say this, none of us is as smart as all of us.
We're just creating rules on the fly. Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. If you are just joining us, know that we're creating rules on the fly. On Tuesdays, none of us is as smart as all of us, and that's because Tuesday is our big, long show where we dive into a single topic. We get some help, and we need it because we are finally getting to the episode that we've been promising and you've been asking for and that I had a whole brunch conversation about this weekend, so clearly it's time to talk again about Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is here. It's getting real. It's moving more mainstream-ish, although I want to talk about that little angle of it a little bit. But also, it's getting very, very publicly traded because Coinbase, the biggest crypto exchange in the country, goes public when? Tomorrow, right? Wednesday? So it's happening. It's happening.
It really is. So we actually we're doing a guest crossover event, which I promised in the podcast accidentally because it turns out it's going to be great. Here to make us smart is Gil Luria, who I just talked to if you listened to Marketplace Tech this morning. He's a managing director at D.A. Davidson Institutional Research and I believe author of the first research note by a Wall Street analyst respect to Bitcoin. So, Gil, can you confirm or deny? And welcome back.
Yes, all the way back in 2013, I was, the first Wall Street analyst that took Bitcoin seriously. Published a report saying that I think it's very interesting, that it could be going places, and it was very well received, especially by the Bitcoin community.
Well, I'm sure it was very well received by the Bitcoin community, yes. I read an article about it in The Street where they referred to you and I think maybe your co-author as having the, quote, guts to talk about Bitcoin. It sounds like everybody was like, we don't want to touch it back then.
Yeah, and look at where we are today. We're going to have a listing of a company that all they do is Bitcoin and crypto, and they're going to probably have $100 billion valuation tomorrow.
Man. All right, so let me climb in here with something I heard you say to Molly on Tech this morning that kind of made it real for me. You said, look, Bitcoin's been around for 11 years now, going on 12, and if it was going to implode, it would have happened by now. It's here to stay, right? I mean, it's not going anywhere.
That's exactly right. And in fact, it's been under constant attack ever since then. Because if you can break Bitcoin, you could take all the Bitcoin and spend it again, double spend, right? If you had the ability to figure out how to break the code, you could get $1 trillion. So people have been trying throughout to do that, and they have not yet succeeded. And that's part of the reason we see Bitcoin going mainstream now, is that it's proven itself. It's proven itself resilient. It's a robust network that allows people to send each other value without an intermediary, and it's held up.
I feel like we should do a quick vocabulary check because Bitcoin has become kind of shorthand for cryptocurrency writ large, and it seems like the underlying blockchain technology. At this point, though, like how many cryptocurrencies are we actually talking about?
Well, there's thousands. There's thousands. Most of them are meaningless. Most of them are experiments. Let's not forget that these are all open source software. And so you could take the Bitcoin open source software and make whatever changes you want and create your own coin. And that's what people do. And it's great and it's creative. But realistically speaking, there's only a handful, maybe a dozen cryptocurrencies, crypto assets that are of substantial size and have a substantial following.
And then the underlying blockchain technology, explain how that fits into this whole thing. Because that gets rolled out and people say, oh, well, we can put this on the blockchain and that on the blockchain. And that is separate from a cryptocurrency.
It's one of the things that makes a crypto asset a crypto asset. And really, the easiest way to think about it, it's just a database that's shared and anybody can read. But in order to write on it, you'd have to have certain privileges. And that makes it very unique because it's not managed by any one individual or intermediary. It's open source software. Any computer that hosts it has a has an image, a copy of this database. And the reason that gets people interested in thinking is, well, that's a really good way to keep track of who owns what. Mm-hmm. If we have this database that we share, then anybody can see what it says, but you can only write on it if you have the right privilege. Then we can keep track of who owns what a lot better. Who owns what stock? Who owns what currency? Who owns what house? And that's really where people get excited about the technology. And those are some of the tools people are trying to build right now.
Okay.
So in those early days, it sort of seemed like people got really excited about blockchain. And then blockchain, it seems to have just been sort of quietly absorbed, right? That technology is just happening, chugging along. Mm-hmm. People are adopting it. And all of a sudden, cryptocurrency, which seemed almost like the lost leader or something for the blockchain technology, is the cool thing that is getting so much traction and making people so much money, right? Do you think that's a fair assessment of like this shift?
Open source software can be used by anybody for whatever use they want to use it for. You could take this crypto technology and you could decide that all you want to do is use Bitcoin to pay for coffee. You could decide that you wanted to invest in another crypto asset long-term. You can trade and speculate on yet another crypto asset. And you can use this technology to build commercial tools that will allow the transfer of various goods, services, and assets. Anybody can use it however they want. And at various times, people get excited about other uses. But to be fair, the most important use for crypto assets, for Bitcoin specifically, up until now has been as an investment and a speculative investment at that. But it's worked out for those that bought Bitcoin, especially those that bought it early.
Yeah, but doesn't it have to then somehow make the transition? And I guess this is part of what you guys were talking about on Tech This Morning. It has to make the transition from an asset class where you just buy it and hold it because you can't really do anything with it. And I point out here that, you know, Bitcoin crossed like $62,000 a pop this morning, right? It has to make that transition from asset class to actual negotiable currency. And I say that as a guy who got in his inbox this morning a Flack email that said, America's oldest wine shop now accepts Bitcoin. So that's the transition point we're at, right? We have to be able to spend it easily and readily. Is that fair?
Yes. And that's happening. Among other things, that's happening. When PayPal says, hey, you can put crypto in your PayPal wallet, what that really means is that the tens of millions of PayPal merchants that sell online are now accepting Bitcoin. And so that's happening. But if you think about what the main use of Bitcoin has been and the big belief that some of the true believers have, they think Bitcoin will turn into all of money at some point, that there's not going to be dollars and euros and yuan. Hmm. That at some point, Bitcoin, because it technologically is better than the money we use now, will become all of money, and then we'll use it for everything. We don't have to believe that that's a likelihood, but I think we're starting to accept that it's a possibility. And if it's a possibility, that means a lot for what the value of Bitcoin is, and it also means a lot for what companies are going to do in terms of acceptance and incorporating crypto assets and crypto technology into what they're planning for the future.
So do you think that that increasing likelihood, even if it's still small, the possibility, the whisper of that likelihood is why institutional investors are now dipping in a toe in a bigger way?
I think it's part of the thinking. When you see companies like Tesla or Square start putting Bitcoin and crypto assets as part of their treasury program, meaning part of the money that they hold in the bank, that tells you that they think that maybe one day they're going to pay their vendors with Bitcoin and they're preparing for that world. And that's part of what's made it interesting for corporations. What's made it interesting for institutional investors is that it goes up a lot, is that the returns on Bitcoin and other crypto assets have been spectacular, and money managers, hedge funds, and institutional investors of other types are in the business of making money, and they're increasingly feeling that maybe they're missing the boat. And so those are a couple of the reasons that we're seeing more institutional money, both institutional investors and enterprise companies buying Bitcoin and crypto assets.
Okay, but FOMO seems to me to be a bad reason to make something an actual currency, right? I mean, let's say your employer comes to you and says, hey, Gil, we will give you your pay in Bitcoin or we will give you your pay in American dollars, and one has been outrageously volatile over the past 11 years and the other one has been reasonably stable. Which one are you going to pick?
Well, if you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I better have said Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. One of the things that makes Bitcoin not necessarily the most attractive option for day-to-day transactions is A, the volatility, and B, in the United States, tax consequences.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not sure that the best application for crypto assets right now are buying coffee. I'm not sure that's the best application. But for the dreamers, for the true believers, mm-hmm. they believe that one day we're not just going to be buying coffee with Bitcoin. We're going to be buying everything with crypto. And that's part of what gives Bitcoin value, is that belief that if a Bitcoin becomes all of money or a crypto asset becomes all of money, each unit of Bitcoin is worth $1 million. And that's, if you even discount that by a certain very low probability, that still has value today.
Mm-hmm. What does that start to look for? I want to pick up on another thread that you brought up on tech, which was that if we transition to cryptocurrency globally or even nationally, that a massive sector of businesses will go away, the financial middlemen. Can you break that down for us here as well?
They will certainly have to be transformed. If we're saying that the essence of crypto technology is the ability to transfer value without an intermediary, about 20% of our economy are intermediaries, financial firms, real estate firms, accountants, lawyers. What they do is that they help facilitate transactions between two parties that don't know and trust each other. If you can do that using technology, in this case, crypto technology, what do they really do? How does their business look like? And the forward-looking ones are already starting to think through that, think about how they would look like in a world like that. And just like any big shifts in technology, some companies are going to figure it out and survive, and others are going to fall by the wayside.
All right, so let's take – there are a couple of listener questions that we got, which I think are a couple of them are kind of interesting. Could you – and this one's from Isabel, and I'll paraphrase – could you talk about Bitcoin mining and how we get them? And she's got a great visual here, right? She says, right now, I'm just thinking of Minecraft characters pounding rocks. How do we get Bitcoin?
It's probably better to use terminology we use in other parts of technology. A Bitcoin miner is a transaction processor. So just like Visa has these massive data centers that process transactions that they own, Bitcoin, part of the clever part of the technology in Bitcoin and other crypto assets is that they've decentralized that. Anybody can own a data center that processes transactions. And the way they get paid is there's a random chance in any given 10-minute cycle that they'll get all the Bitcoin produced in that cycle. And so you have independent entrepreneurial transaction processors that process all the transactions in the network because they know that they're gonna, over time, get paid to do that. And in fact, they get paid very handsomely to do that right now, which is why they contribute that processing power, that computing power to the network. Not because they're owned by Bitcoin or a central entity, but because the technology, the software makes it worth their while by issuing Bitcoin to them periodically.
I want to go to another listener question, but first I want to go back to the idea of the U.S. and a digital currency, because there is conversation now about China creating a digital yuan. Jerome Powell on 60 Minutes said the Fed is evaluating the possibility of having digital currency in the U.S. Digital currency, of course, potentially very different, right, from open source cryptocurrency. Like, how likely is it that a government would move in that direction?
Very likely. And we're not sure what that's going to look like, but governments will issue digital currencies and see if they can be competitive that way. And it's very important to think of it as another front in our technology competition with China. We compete with them for semiconductors, for artificial intelligence. we need to be competitive with China. As the United States, we need to be competitive with them in the world of crypto, crypto technology. And one of the ways that there's going to be competition in the future is which country, which central bank issues the most compelling version of a digital currency. Now, back to our earlier conversation, if you're a true Bitcoin believer, you're foaming at the, really excited about the prospect of governments going into digital currency, because your perspective is that Bitcoin can beat them, that on a level playing field, Bitcoin will be the superior technology. But I'm really curious to see what governments come up with, because they're not ignoring it. Governments or central banks are not ignoring this trend, and they will come up with what they feel are good technological solutions to the same problems Bitcoin and crypto assets are trying to solve.
And just to real quick here on this, there's no guarantee that the Federal Reserve's slash the U.S. government's cryptocurrency is the one that catches on, right? I mean, you know, the U.S. dollar in paper and actual money is the reserve currency of the global economy, not necessarily in the cryptocurrency future.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Once you change what the playing field is, the rules of the game change. And we have to think about it that way. We have to continue to compete. The prominence of the U.S. dollar has been a very important part of why the United States has succeeded as a country. And it's very important that it keeps that leadership position.
What would, I know we're running out of time, but I can't let it go. What would make a government cryptocurrency more or less compelling? Like, are you talking about technological expertise? Should there be built-in features? Like, what would it mean if we make a janky one?
We just need to think of that as senders and receivers of value. If the U.S. digital currency is the one that's easiest to send and receive and has the lowest cost to do that, it'll win. If it's the easiest to keep track of, it'll win. It's that's how we increasingly think of money and financial transactions: ease of use, lower cost. Those are going to be the competitive imperatives.
Man, gotta hope we don't mess that up.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I know. We could totally screw it up. Wow. Okay. Should we do Sarah's question?
Yeah,
I will say quick. This question came up at my brunch this weekend. So let's help the ladies out. We got this from Sarah in Virginia.
This is Sarah from Richmond, Virginia. And I would like to be made smart about the limited amount of Bitcoin being 21 million and why that is. And what exactly is the calculation that all of these computers have to do? It seems like they're just trying to guess a number, and my brain just can't wrap around that. Thanks.
Yeah, Gil, where did that 21 million come from? Like the original white paper, right? Help us understand this.
Well, that's right. The original release of the software indicated in the software a path towards 21 million in at a declining rate of issuance. Now, it doesn't matter that it's 21 million versus any other number. What matters is that the number is finite and known. Why? Mm-hmm. Because what gives an asset value is when there's utility and scarcity. We've talked a lot about the utility of Bitcoin and crypto assets, but if there isn't scarcity, if there's an unlimited amount of it, it doesn't have value. What gives Bitcoin and crypto assets value is the combination of utility and scarcity. So the number is an arbitrary number, but the fact that it's finite is what's important. What those transaction processors do in terms of solving a math equation is they try to come up with what source string, if you run a hash function on it, gives you the desired outcome. That's the simple way of saying you have to run a lot of calculations very, very quickly to solve that problem, which means that these transaction processors are always in an arms race to have the fastest chips and the most fastest chips in order to win each one of those 10-minute competitions to process the transactions.
Wow. Right. And the declining issuance is because the more you create, the harder it gets to create more.
That's right. And as predicted, they're becoming more and more valuable. So the fact that every 4 years, the rate of production gets halved, it catches up with the fact that the value of the asset has ascended so much. It's worked out for those miners, those transaction processors, and it's worked out for the network because it continues to function.
Gil Luria is the managing director at D.A. Davidson Institutional Research. I am certain that you all have more questions, so keep them coming. But Gil, thank you. I'm glad we could keep the conversation going.
Thanks for having me.
Take good care.
Good stuff.
If I had a nickel for every time when someone has asked me about blockchain or Bitcoin, they use the exact same words that Sarah used, which is my brain can't wrap around that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And
I would be able to buy a Bitcoin.
Right. And it's just one, though, maybe a half. That's part of the challenge with this thing, right, is getting people to wrap their brains around how it works, because you're like, no, give me a damn dollar bill, right? Don't give me any of this Bitcoin stuff. And I totally get that.
And it is going to become this kind of like fascinating process of ongoing education. I was thinking about what he said about the time frame. I read a report years ago from, I think, the Consumer Electronics Association, and they said that any new technology has basically a 10-year adoption cycle. Like, it takes 10 years before it finds its niche or purpose or matures into something that people can understand. And I think Bitcoin may have a slightly longer process than that, but it certainly has had a 10 to 11 year process of like awareness.
Yeah.
And then we might have to start teaching classes on this in school or something. Because,
great, great.
Yep. All right. We're headed to a break. Send us your comments, or I imagine your questions, on today's show, but hopefully it helped a little bit. You can do that by sending us an email or a voice memo, ideally, to makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
All right, we're back. We are back. We are back. We are back. And we're going to do a little news.
We're back. This is the moment that Kai has been waiting
for.
He did us the favor of going through the interview, but let's be real, he didn't want to. So I'm just going to say, I feel like I'm just going to drop mine, because, like, what's the point?
No, go ahead.
I don't know.
Good. Come on.
Something's happening in the SPAC world where the SEC seems to be trying to do something, and it's related to accounting, and it's really complicated, and I don't totally understand, because I don't totally know what, like, a warrant is, but it's something, it's a thing that's issued to early investors in SPAC deals. SPACs, of course, being, by the way, the special purpose acquisition company, the blank check companies that get formed. They themselves are public, and then they only exist to sneak other companies into the party. And now the SEC is like, all right, we are going to start with an accounting rule that will change the way you're allowed to account for your early investment in one of these companies that's going public via a SPAC. And likely it is the start of, I think, an overall chill.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think that's hotness. Right. Yeah.
I think that's exactly what this means.
Maybe I don't have to understand the accounting law. The accounting change specifically, but what I do understand is the SEC is like, this party has gotten out of control.
That's right. And I think anytime you hear the SEC say that, it's got that chilling effect. I think that's exactly right. Okay, my turn?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I'm poking around this morning for news, blah, 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 going, whatever, yada, yada. Inflation, we talked about that yesterday. It's up. It came out this morning. It's up over a year ago, but we knew that was going to happen, blah, blah, blah. But...
yeah.
And I will just I point you to the New York Times, a piece by Isabella Kwai today out of London. The subhead says this: measuring more than 4 feet, the furry giant should be easy to spot, but he vanished from an English garden last weekend, and the police are treating his disappearance as an abduction. His name is Darius. He is the world's longest rabbit. He weighs 50 pounds, and somebody stole him. And I am outraged. I am outraged. This is a bunny rabbit. It looks more like a dog, but it's a bunny rabbit. And you got to see the picture. This lady is holding up Darius at full length. He's 4 feet long. He's also old, by the way. He can no longer reproduce. He needs a special diet or he will die.
Maybe.
So please give him back. If you're within the sound of my voice, and if you are, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast, but thanks. Give the bunny back. Give the bunny back.
You're so nice. I'm like, you find that bee? A-S-T-A-R-D, and you, like, you monster!
Yes.
So. Monster. I, by the way, like follow like six giant bunnies on
Instagram. Oh, do you
Instagram. Really? They are, yeah. I mean, this couldn't be more. I saw this story and I was like, this is my wheelhouse. I'm so excited because I have some friends who have a bunny and they're pretty obsessed with the bunny. That happens apparently. Then I got down the, oh God, I literally almost unironically said down the rabbit hole.
That's right.
Of the That's giant right. bunnies. And yeah, you monster, whoever you are, you're a monster.
Back. Bring it back. And look, I fully
bring
realize,
the bunny back.
I fully realize this is more of a make me smile item than a news fix, but deal.
Except it's not. It's
I can
a,
do whatever
it's
I
a
want.
Grand public shaming.
There
How
you go.
Dare you?
Okay, I'm done.
Okay. Look, we cover a lot of ground here.
Yes.
All right. You do too. So that's it for us. Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
As do I. Our first item comes from Levi, a biomedical researcher at Rutgers, because we have empirically the smartest audience in America, I think. He left us this voice memo about data science reporting.
Kimberly and Megan have talked a lot about conflicting information, both on Twitter and in the press. And I feel like I need to address that. So in the field of research, we are really aggressively taught to explain our science to other scientists, but not to everyone else. We learn to never make definitive statements without a huge list of exceptions and limitations. And while this is crucial for good science, it makes for terrible press releases. I've really noticed that reporting on science tends to focus on statements as absolute facts, or focus only on the exceptions. And this generates mixed or even conflicting messages that don't reflect the original idea. So when the CDC said 3 feet is okay in schools, it actually came with a list of limitations that were ignored in favor of the headline number. The apparently conflicting statement from the White House seemed, to me at least, to be recognition that people would hear 3 feet, ignore all the rest, and just stop socially distancing. This damage control suggests that while most researchers are bad at explaining science, someone has started learning to communicate. Thanks for keeping us smart.
Yeah, look, I think that's totally true. And it's playing out today in the J&J announcement, the pause because of those six reported cerebral blood
Some
clots,
kind
right?
Of blood, cl-
blood clot, right? At a 7 million doses. And I think scientific communication is really important because people are going to read the headlines and they're going to intuit that J&J causes cerebral hemorrhages. And that's not true. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, or we don't know what's true yet, and we're still trying to figure it out, and and everybody is really bad at that. I mean, there is such an argument to be made that this pandemic is coming at a perfect storm of disastrous responses, right? We have had lots and lots of declining investment in public health. We had a government that just did not have the chops, right, as Amy Webb put it to us, the futurist, to deal with it. We had political partisanship. We had social media spreading rampant disinformation, and we are not going to let ourselves off the hook here. You absolutely have a media that loves a definitive headline. Mm-hmm. The more clicks, the better. You absolutely have, you know, an industry of explaining, like which we do on this podcast right now. Like, oh, we'll explain this thing to you as though we actually know what we're talking about. Harken all the way back to Vox saying, is this going to become a pandemic? No, period. That's what they, right? Like, so you have a whole bunch of things that collide to confuse people.
Yeah.
Combined with the fact that, it's not the job of scientists to be like, no, period, ever, or yes, period, ever. But we've trained everybody to not deal with nuance at all.
Right. That's exactly right.
I mean, this J&J thing is like, it's a disaster on so many levels. Communication, trust.
All right. Tom in Iowa, go.
I have an idea for a date of demarcation of when we can declare the pandemic is over. Remember when that Japanese amusement park encouraged its patrons to scream inside your heart when enjoying its more thrilling rides? Well, I suggest that we can officially declare the pandemic over when that same amusement park lets people scream outside of their hearts. Thanks for your authenticity over the past year. Introducing me to the Batanga, and I owe Kai a surly Todd the Axeman when I'm in the neighborhood again. Thanks.
I hear Todd left a surly brewery, so now it's just called Axeman. But anyway, yes. Yes.
Man, you are a nerd. You're a beer nerd.
I am. I'm a beer nerd and a beer snob all at the same time.
Wow. All at the same time. I mean, I say that with respect.
I appreciate that.
About things, yeah. Screen, yeah. When it's, yes. Okay, let's, can we call them? Can we call that amusement park and see if...
Yes, see when they're going to announce
They're letting people scream outside their hearts, because that's wonderful. That's amazing. And then finally, at long last, and I'm freaking delighted, because I'm also obsessed with this story, a voice memo about cicadas.
Hello, make me smart. This is Jeff from Austin, Texas. I lived in Indiana, in Indianapolis specifically, the last time the 17-year cicadas came out, which, wow, that was a long time ago. But anyway, people go crazy about it. There was a guy that was interviewed. He had cicadas left in his freezer from the previous 17 years and was excited to go catch them.
Wow.
He sautés them up, and apparently they taste kind of nutty. Imagine, I think he said, like a walnut kind of thing. Anyway, they're also deafening. When you're driving down the road, if you're driving past where a bunch of them are at and they're up out making noise, you can hear it in your car. And then when you get out, it's like kind of a weird disorienting just hum in the background all the time. Love the show. And thanks for helping us make sense of everything.
Can I ask an uninformed cicada question? It's East Coast only, right? I mean, I was out here in California 17 years ago and I remember reading everything about it, but we never saw any out here, right? It's an East Coast deal.
I don't even know if it's East Coast. I thought it was like Midwest to Southeast.
I don't know. Somebody tell us.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's, I don't think it's coastal. Because Kimberly was saying actually on that episode that she was like, oh, we do not have that. I think it's more Southeast, Midwest. But also, please, guys, when they start coming out, like, will someone record that for us?
Yeah, record a voice memo for sure.
That would be amazing. And yeah, catch a bunch. I mean, like food source. I'm just saying.
Well, look, it's probably
the apocalypse.
It's probably super protein loaded. And, you know, if you fry them, how bad can it taste?
Yeah.
Serious question.
Walnutty.
There we go. All right.
Story. It's great. It's our new theme. Anywho, okay, we're going now. We're going. We'll be back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday.
Sorry, I'm Googling cicadas.
We will have the answer for you.
Yes.
By tomorrow and long before on Twitter, I'm sure. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera, who is so wonderful and so patient. Tony Wagner is our digital producer, who has been educating our new Discord on why the Kardashian business model really matters. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skill, and therefore knows everything about everything.
Say what you will about the Kardashian family. Kim specifically, she's a hell of a businesswoman. Truly. We've tried to get on our marketplace a bunch of times.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Reels. Charlton Thorpe engineered today. Emma Erdbrink's going to mix it later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez wrote our theme music. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And that is it. We are out of here.
I mean, they basically create, especially Kylie Jenner, actually, the one with all the controversy.
Yeah.
Like, they created the creator economy.
Yeah.
That's why everybody thinks they can make money as, like, a makeup influencer.
Yeah, totally agree.